Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Lunch Pail Podcast. Alongside Mike Nizelik, the Virginia Tech football beat writer for the Roanoke Times, this is Aaron McFarling, sports columnist for the Roanoke Times. I'm giggling a bit because I've been pronouncing Mike's name incorrectly this entire life of this podcast and also on our videos that we do. I heard him pronounce his own name at one point recently, and I said, if I've been doing this wrong, he's like, it's okay, I don't care.
It felt awkward to chime in. And when do you do that? So it's like, because I'd always forget by the time something would end. I mean, I don't care. My name's been pronounced wrong many a time.
Well, so. I certainly apologize for that. It was unintentional.
I think it's better. I wish it would have gone on 5 years.
Well, we have a meaty, meaty podcast today. I mean, we've got coaching changes here at Tech. We've got the bowl game to look ahead to against Kentucky. We got to look back at the UVA game because we have not gotten together. We had a busy week last week. We weren't able to get together after the Commonwealth Cup streak ended. We'll touch on the ACC title game that Clemson ran over UVA in, and we'll do our pick three. But we're going to kind of go in reverse or chronological order here with the most recent item of news. Second most recent, I guess, would be the Justin Hamilton hire, the decision to promote him from safeties coach to defensive coordinator to replace Bud Foster. Mike, just your initial thoughts on that decision.
Well, it was a possibility, I think, in the back of everybody's head collectively, sort of at least the media realm here, that, you know, Hamilton could be a guy that they really liked him, energetic. The players really players love this guy. I mean, he was the director of development for a season, then took over as safeties coach. He's been here 2 years, but immediately, I think, got the respect, and that locker room loves him. So, I mean, he had that going for him. Experience-wise, a little different. Not a guy with tons of experience. Wrote about that this week. Spent some time over at VMI prior to coming to Virginia Tech. He was a linebackers coach over there. Had some time with UVA Wise, which I didn't know was a thing until looking up his experience. He was the defensive coordinator there. That's his own only coordinator experience. That's at the Division II level. So certainly not what you'd call an experienced hire by any means. Only 1 year at FBS level of position coach. So I think with that, you know, there's always a certain amount of surprise when you kind of promote a young candidate. But it makes, I think, a certain amount of sense in that you're staying in-house, you're picking a guy that Bud Foster wanted to bring here in the first place, wanted to bring him on staff, I think, the year before when they hired Tyrone Nix, and, you know, they wanted to kind of give him a little seasoning. So maybe ahead of the game, but I think it sort of fits with Virginia Tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote a little something about this when it happened, and I knew Justin from his days of playing, and he was a guy that we would seek out as media members just to get his thoughts on what was going on out there, because he had such a good feel for the game. He played multiple positions. He was a team first guy all the way. And, he obviously very eloquent in the way he expressed himself back then. So it doesn't surprise me that he would impress the coaching staff, particularly Bud Foster, who lobbied for the guy. I mean, who went to bat for him. And as I wrote in the column, I mean, the defense, the philosophy, the strategy, the whole culture of the defense is not broken. It's not a scenario where usually when you have a change, and we'll get into the changes they're having in the defense, which kind of runs counter to my point about that. But I saw you smiling a little bit over there. But yeah,
I get what you're saying. You go when you have an offensive head coach, you fire him. Right. You go with a defensive head coach, or you go with somebody that's like Foster, who's intense, and you go with somebody maybe that's laid back, or the opposite. I get what your general
exactly.
Point.
I mean, they don't need to get rid of the lunch pail. They don't.
They don't need to throw it away.
They don't need a turnover taco or something like that to roll in here. They need what they've had for decades, maybe with a little bit of a younger edge to it in recruiting and things like that. But I think the biggest thing for him is, people came to Tech. A lot of defensive players came to Tech. Dax Holyfield's an extreme example. But there's others who came to Tech because Bud Foster was the coordinator.
They want to breathe in his air, and then seeing that aura of that sort of what he's meant to this school and that three decades worth of success and those players and the draft picks. I get what you're saying.
Which is why I would believe that Justin's first year as defensive coordinator is going to be very important. You got to show that there's not a significant drop off in culture, in performance. And, you know, they should have the personnel to have a pretty good season defensively.
Yeah, if this was 2 years ago when they were caught, when, you know, if Bud had stepped down after they lost everybody to the draft and were coming in with a, you know, nine new starters and nine guys with no experience, this would look like, I think, a completely different hire. When you're returning everybody except Reggie Floyd, unless there's more attrition,
right,
which on the defensive side, it's really hard to picture other than maybe Caleb Farley possibly looking at the NFL draft or considering that, which I think is a kind of a high hill to climb for him. Other than that, you're bringing everybody back. So it's certainly, I think, the defense, the way it's set up, fits hiring somebody that's a little more inexperienced, a little younger. And, you know, Bud Foster's not leaving Blacksburg. He's keeping his wherever his lake house is. I'm not sure where exactly
Smith Mountain Lake.
Smith Mountain Lake. So he'll be here. I said he's going to be an ambassador of the program.
Clater Lake.
That's right.
Yeah.
I said he's going to be an ambassador of the program. But I'd venture a guess, and maybe Justin Fuente will talk about this on Wednesday when he kind of addresses the media for the first time, that Foster will help out and be a mentor and be available to sort of, you know, provide him that fallback to kind of help him through some of these tough times. And they still, and we'll get to this, like you said, they have some hires to make to kind of bring in some experience as well. But, you know, on the surface, the one thing Hamilton has is he's familiar, like you said, he's played a lot of positions, almost every position in the secondary. He's familiar with the system. He has, what, you know, 5 years of playing experience because he redshirted, and then now, you know, 2 years back. So it's not like he's coming in without any sort of base for this what Foster did. So, I mean, I saw some criticism, and I think that I'm not sure how much that is fair with just having a year, that the safeties didn't kind of leaps and bounds improve under Hamilton. I thought Shamari Connor played well and had a good season. Devon Diablo played pretty well. Reggie Floyd didn't make a step forward, but I don't think the unit was dreadful. But, I mean, you know, maybe you would have liked to see a little more, but I don't think that speaks to what success he can or can't have as a defensive coordinator. I think it's kind of a different world.
Well, there's not a lot of coordinators. There's not a lot of parallels to draw with coordinators that leave after a quarter century at the position, right? But are there parallels anywhere that you've found throughout the nation where, you know, someone's been the coordinator for a long time and rather than go with the sexy outside hire, they elevated someone from within who was relatively
Yeah, I don't know about
40.
That. I mean, that's hard to look for. But I did look to see, you know, parallels with young coaches kind of without much experience kind of at the Division I level. And you know, it's hard to kind of find guys. But, you know, it's interesting that I think the parallels to Bud Foster's situation where Frank Beamer kind of took a chance on him where he didn't have a lot of experience at Murray State yet and brought him on. It was as a position coach initially at Virginia Tech. But I certainly think there's some parallels there where you kind of take a chance on a young coach and you believe in him and you kind of give him that additional responsibility. This is on a bigger level. But that kind of drew me that Frank Beamer sort of took a chance on Bud at a similar stage where he would, you know, he had no real experience when he came over to Virginia Tech and took over the linebackers, got more before he took over as defensive coordinator and was co-coordinator, but called all the plays his first year. But that kind of was the parallel I thought too, that, you know, the coaching tree here has a long history of sort of, once you like somebody and once you believe in somebody to kind of trust them.
What do we make of the timing of this announcement? I mean, it was made the day they were going to announce the bowl matchups in the morning on a day where, you know, a lot of the media is traveling back from Charlotte or wherever they are. And you know, there was no press conference. There was no – it was just a release.
Well, because they got to do – they're on the road recruiting right after.
Okay.
Which is why there was no press conference. But why the why time at that? And I was told – they were, I mean, maybe this was foreshadowing the hire a couple weeks before, that they were in no hurry to announce it and that they were, and maybe because they had the guy on the staff. So, you know, we'll kind of see tomorrow what Fuente will say, if they even looked outside, you know, how much did they look outside? I'm not real sure. The timing of it is strange, just because, I mean, if they had Hamilton on staff, you know, did they need to, could they have waited another week when everybody's in town and kind of introduced him properly? Probably with some of the coaching, other coaching changes they want to make, they decided they probably needed to pull the trigger on everything as they were kind of trying to organize everything. And, you know, with early signing day, with a couple of their recruits that maybe they're trying to get, they thought maybe this would help with some of the uncertainty. But, yeah, it's a strange timing just in the sense where, you know, they're not even introducing him this week. Fuente's talking at a Bull press conference that he's going to address the defensive coordinator change. You know, that's
in
that's
Charlotte.
In
yeah.
Charlotte, yeah. So that's a little strange. But that's sort of typical now of how things operate. They don't really operate on sort of a media timeline or anything. They don't really care. The optics of it are secondary to just getting it done and kind of moving forward. So
gotcha.
I'm not sure that was in their calculus at all. They you know, Fuente really cares. Just, you know, he's going to announce it and then he's on to the next thing.
Right. Well, some of the next things he was on to, well, including the same day, the same press release that they announced the Hamilton hire, they announced.
That was more interesting. The
sort of, yeah, just snuck it in there with the second to last paragraph.
No, the last sentence that on the Hamilton's hired, you know, it's like the press release. It's got quotes from Bud and Justin and both Justins and. It's, you know, good length, probably 400 words, 500 words.
Yeah.
And then in the last sentences, and we will not be bringing back running back coach Zon Berdan and defensive backs coach Brian Mitchell. That was how they announced that. No follow-up, no heads up on the announcement, just at the end of the press release. Manias, another beat writer here, what they had done in the past. And he said, well, there's not a lot of parallels because Fuente hasn't made many coaching changes. The, you know, Galen Scott resigned and stepped down. That was a much different situation. And, you know, Frank did a couple of times, but they didn't really announce him until they had a hire in place. So there was not a lot of parallels to that. But I've been through coaching changes at other schools, and that seems sort of surprising that they just say, oh, by the way, these guys are no longer in the building.
Why are they gone?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, on its face, we should also add Charlie Wiles.
Well, I wanted to get to Charlie separately.
So three coaches are gone. So we'll start with Berdan and Mitchell. Berdan, I think the kind of lack of production speaks for itself the last 4 years. I mean, I haven't had a 1,000-yard back. Stephen Peoples has been your most successful running back, and, I mean, he was okay, but didn't light the world on fire. They got better as this season went on, but – I mean, how much improvement have those guys shown other than Deshaun McLeese, I think, took some step forward. I would think that had a lot to do with it because he was a pretty good recruiter. I mean, he was their best recruiter of the cycle last year. Players really loved him. So I would think that the production kind of just wasn't there. I mean, even when they were better, they still weren't averaging over 4 yards a carry for much of the season, and they hadn't, you know, really the running game wasn't consistent outside of Jarrod Evans, you know. And Hendon, I think, kind of opened things up, but I don't think it was part of the running game necessarily. So I think there's that. Brian Mitchell, I thought, was kind of the head scratcher of the group because of what those guys have been able to do, what he was able to do with Caleb Farley this year and Jermaine Waller and even Armani Chapman, who tweeted some things just about being kind of surprised and upset. And that happens. I mean, these guys are close. So, but recruiting-wise, I think that might have had more to do with his. But we'll kind of see here when we do get a chance to talk to Fuente what his reasoning was, because maybe it was different, or, you know, I'm not sure. But those are just kind of on the surface what you kind of look at. Because coaching-wise, Mitchell had a good season this year in terms of the production from Farley and Waller from a year ago where they were with no experience. He sort of brought them along. But out of those two, I certainly thought Mitchell was the more surprising one because they just haven't had a dominant back. I mean, you wrote about this, every year at least once, that they didn't have a dominant back.
Been a recurring theme for sure, and read about it multiple times in several seasons, including this one. Okay, Charlie Wiles. This is a guy, how long has he been?
24 years.
Love Charlie. Charlie is, he's really good at what he does. That defensive line has been a strength of Virginia Tech for a very long time. He's also doesn't take himself too seriously, which I love. I mean, he's very serious about his job, but he's, you know, he's also fun to be around and talk to and laugh with. And he's been a big integral part of their success. He got his own press release the following day, right? Monday is when
I think they were going to allow him to coach the bowl game if he wanted. Mm-hmm. I think he declined because I think he's going to be looking for another job. You know, he told us all, I think, I don't know if you were there or not.
I was there, yeah.
But when he's like, you know, I'm younger than Bud. I'm not looking to kind of retire yet. No, I got a couple, I got some good years left in me. So
yeah, that was mid-season.
Mid-season. So I don't think that's changed. And that's why I thought that kind of that was a day later. I thought they probably were having some discussions with him and still trying to finalize. Because, you know, not that they, I mean, it was pretty unceremonious the way they dumped Burton and Mitchell. I don't think they wanted that for Charlie because he had been such an integral part. But these things are always tough. So, I mean, you know, pull the Band-Aid off for him, I think, from his perspective. But, yeah, so that's kind of how that developed.
Are we to assume that maybe this was Charlie's decision?
I don't think so.
You don't think so? I was wondering if maybe because he didn't get the defensive coordinator job, he was upset.
Maybe, and that could have been Mitchell's too. I mean, maybe that they balked at sort of going with the younger guy. But we'll see. You know, that's something for Fuente to answer if that was any part of that, or it was all Virginia Tech's side. And I think they don't provide – they're all on, like, letters of appointment, so you can't FOIA, you can't request those things. But I think they were all on – 2-year contracts that expired this way. Like, if you look at the announcements, they parted ways with and not fired. So I don't think they had contracts after. I'm pretty sure other than Jafar and guys they brought in kind of last year and Hamilton, I don't think that they had contracts after this season. I think they were all on 2-year deals.
Well,
but I'm not 100% sure on that.
The next press release that uses the term fired will be the first. But, yes, they didn't say
– No, but sometimes – but they would dismiss. They didn't even use dismiss. Right, they said they're just not bringing him back, and so that usually means their contract's expired and they weren't being renewed.
Gotcha.
But with Charlie, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, he's had success, and I think he got a lot out of his freshmen this year and a lot out of some of the guys. You know, Deshaun Crawford had a very good season, but – the depth at defensive line and defensive tackle specifically has been an issue kind of throughout the time he's been here with Coach Fuente. And they've had a real trouble recruiting, and his style was recruiting kind of undersized guys, faster guys. And maybe they want to go in a more modern direction with, you know, some size up front. Cause they haven't, that's not something they've had here very much in recent years. And so they've kind of gone for a different style, especially at tackle. And so I think you kind of got to look and see maybe philosophically they wanted to go in a little bit of a different direction. And, you know, they might not have been happy with recruiting on the defensive front because the defensive tackle, I mean, they were relying on junior college guys and true freshmen this year, and that's not a recipe for long-term success.
Right. Well, it will be interesting to see A, what Hamilton says about all of this when we do get a chance to talk to him. B, who they end up hiring to fill these jobs. And C, I will not be at the press conference tomorrow, but that should be a lot of fun in Charlotte, where they want to ballyhoo the bowl, and all you guys want to talk about is defense.
Well, it's a terrible setup.
It is.
It's not
your fault.
Silly. No, it's not our fault. But I've asked, and we'll see if they come through, you know, because I've been at multiple bowl press conferences where the subjects have never been about them. Nobody in the media, like, there's nothing you could say other than, like, do you talk about Kentucky, you preview Kentucky. And especially right now, we're still 3 weeks away from the game. So you're not even asking those questions yet. We'll get those chances down the road. So there's really nothing to say about the bowl yet. And what can you say about going to a bowl game other than, well, love Charlotte, love X city that the bowl game is, love the stadium, love the, you know, whatever. And then there's nothing else to talk about that. But the bowl people don't really understand that. They want you to spend 10 minutes like, how great is Charlotte compared
Queen
to other?
City,
like, I mean,
baby.
There were 4 other options, but I mean, El Paso, right. Terrible, right? Charlotte's so much better.
They ain't got NASCAR.
Right. So, like, but I've been at multiple press conferences with these things where you start asking questions about players leaving, coaching changes, and they're like, can we get back to the topic at hand? And it's like, okay, so you're not going to make these coaches available. You've announced a defensive coordinator change for the guy that was here for 3 decades, worthy of a special section from the Roanoke Times, and you've made 3 coaching changes, and you've not announced replacements, and you're going to only talk about the Belk Bowl. That's not going to work. And a lot of those times you could sort of say, like, we're not going to get Fuente maybe for another week after that because of the recruiting stuff. So you have to ask these questions now. I mean, we'd be crazy not to, but yeah, it should be fun. It'll be interesting. I don't know how it all unfolds.
I look forward to it.
Because there's so many questions about it. I mean, you know, you got Charlie, you got to ask about all three of them. Hamilton is a subject of his own that's worthy of like 10 minutes to kind of be like, what did you see in him?
Right.
In less than 365 days, you know, less than 2 years where you thought this is the guy that's going to replace Bud, How much did Bud have a say in it? How much did that carry weight? There's so many questions, and we get, you know,
which all have much more weight moving forward, you know, for the history or for the future of this program.
Right, they matter more.
Beat Kentucky in a bowl in Charlotte.
A 7-5 or 7-6 Kentucky team that, you know, is fine, but whatever. We can get into the bowl game.
Yeah,
what are the coaching changes? Were you surprised on any of them? Did you, I mean, Charlie? You surprised about Charlie?
Oh, maybe I just shed a tear for Charlie. I just like Charlie. I mean, and nothing against Burden or nothing against Mitchell. I don't know those guys as well. Charlie's just been around. He's just been a guy you see in the hallway and, you know, just give you a little laugh, you know, that big belly laugh of his. And, you know, there's that story of when he was talking about going to see, what was the movie with Ice Cube?
NWA.
What was it called? Straight Outta Compton. He went and he gave a movie review of Straight Outta Compton, of course, in his thick Appalachian accent. And, you know, that he's picked up over the years. And
From an area where you got to know the assistant coaches. He's really the only one left that you got to know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because I wasn't here for any of that. You got to actually spend time talking to Charlie for two decades. Whereas, like, we get 10 minutes, 20 minutes maybe for the entire season with these guys now. And so you had much more time to get to know Charlie Wiles than I think we get to know any of these guys.
I felt similarly when they parted ways with Billy Height, who was their longtime running backs coach. I mean, that happened years ago now, but Billy was the same way. You know, it had that familial atmosphere that Frank's program engendered. And Bud was able to carry that torch as well. Now you really don't have anybody like that anymore. I mean, you know, but as much as Justin Hamilton is born and bred into this program and is part of this program, he's a different kind of guy than Charlie.
And it's an interesting juxtaposition where you're trying to sort of tether yourself to the previous era while moving forward, mm-hmm. but then you dismiss the guy that probably was the biggest connection and somebody would experience that you thought might be able to help Justin. And, you know, there's still moves to be made, which I think – you know, they'll have to look for some experience. You know, they're going to be looking for a linebackers coach too, and two position coaches. But, you know, that's sort of the strange part of it. It's like, well, we want to kind of embrace the past and look to the future, but then you get rid of the guy that had the biggest connection to what you guys did with the lunch pail defense. So, no, I agree that's sort of a strange sort of dichotomy.
It is. Okay, well, I asked you off air how many juice cartons out of five juice cartons you would give the Belk Bowl matchup between Virginia Tech and Kentucky, and you said half a juice carton.
Half a juice carton. And that's generous.
Well, I am pleased to announce, I hope fans are happy to hear this, but I will be going to the Belk Bowl, and I will not be going to the Orange Bowl. Some people might be upset about that if they were in my shoes because it's Charlotte over Miami. In my case, I'm very pleased. I've seen enough of Miami this year. This is definitely a better time of year to go to Miami than October, but I'm okay with going just and being the Tech columnist, for this bowl period, because the other option was to go, you know, fly down to Florida and spend several days down there, which is nice, but I don't know. I mean, for our readership, I think, you know, even a juiceless matchup in the Belk Bowl is a
well. So
deal.
You said I gave it half a you give it more than a half a juice container
only because of location. I think that a lot of fans love the idea that they can drive there. You know, it feels a little bit. I can't remember who was the SEC foe they faced in the Belk Bowl before.
Arkansas.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like that. In that, you know, when you think SEC. Kentucky's not the, you know, unless you're talking about basketball, Kentucky's not the first team that comes to mind. So it's the ACC,
it's
SEC.
The second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh.
Right, and Arkansas was a similar scenario there. So, you know, but people will go. And they had tarps up at the ACC title game, you know, covering a lot of the seats in the upper deck. And I don't know that they'll need them for this.
I think they will.
You think so?
They only drew 46,000 when Arkansas played.
Is that all?
And it was the high of that 3 years, but not much.
Okay, then they will need the tarps. Yeah, wow, that, so, I'm surprised to hear that number.
I looked it up because I was thinking, like, because, you know, it was kind of just assumed that Belk would get him because of the geography and that they wanted him. But I was thinking, man, that must mean they drew pretty well in the past, you know, in that 16 game, but it wasn't. So, yeah, they drew 46,902 the year before with NC State, 46,423. The year after was bad. Wake Forest and Texas A&M only drew 32,000, which was, and that was a good game. It was 55-52. And South Carolina and Virginia actually drew more fans, was 48,000. So anytime they've had a reasonable geographic connection, they seem to draw around 46. So it wasn't a big jump with Virginia Tech.
Okay. Well, gotcha. Well, you know, Hokies opened as a 1-point dog, and that was quickly bet to Virginia Tech by 3. So, you know, now favored in this game, very similar to the Virginia line and the movement in what we saw there. I just did a quick, you know, we'll obviously learn more about Kentucky as we get closer. I just did a quick look at their, you know, history of this season. It sounds a lot like what Tech did. They didn't start very well. Then they covered the spread in 6 of their last 7 games. They won their last 3 games. One of them was against somebody, you know, unimportant, some non-conference foe. But your snapshot look at Kentucky and what Tech's
just
looking at.
The only thing that's interesting about Kentucky is that they don't have a quarterback. They have a receiver playing quarterback, and they've basically run the ball 95% of the time now. They only attempted 2 passes when they blew out Louisville. Mm-hmm. They've had multiple injuries at quarterback, and they got a receiver who I guess is entering the draft after the season, but going to play in the bowl game. He did a video and announced that. But other than that, I mean, there's no storylines. I mean, it's a bad game for Virginia Tech, right? There's no it's one of those games where there's no upside, because if you lose, you lost to a bad SEC team or average SEC team. If you win, you've won a game you should win against an average SEC team, right? You've envisioned yourself as a better program, and especially more of a football traditional school. So it's a bad matchup in that sense, where if they lose, that's going to even be in a longer offseason. And then they've won 1-2 in bowl games under Fuente, and the only win was that Belk Bowl. So
Where they had to come back
down 24-0. But I mean, yeah, I don't see where you kind of get with juice from this game.
What do they got? 8 wins now, so they're going for 9. So you don't even get that double digit.
No, don't even get double digits.
Yeah, don't want to poop on it too much. I mean, it's
I'm gonna poop on it. They're losing their sponsor. It's not even gonna be the Belk Bowl next year.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
this is all news to me.
The Belk, this is their last. They're going to go out on a high note is what they want to try to do with Virginia Tech and Kentucky. And so, they're going to need a new sponsor next year. And can you name the previous 2 sponsors for the Belk Bowl?
Oh, was it Whedon?
I don't even know what Whedon is.
I want to say like a lawnmower, bad lawnmowers.
A bad lawnmower bowl?
Bad boy mowers. Continental Tire.
That's the first one. That's really impressive. That's the more obscure version.
I covered at least 1 tire bowl.
1 Continental Tire bowl. So that's 1.
I can't even think of that other one.
It's in the same realm. They're connected.
Goodyear.
Meineke Car Care Center. Meineke Car Care Center Bowl. Car Care Bowl. Meineke Car Care Bowl in 2004. So you got the Continental Tire. I thought that would be the one. Meineke is sort of the more memorable names.
I definitely covered a Virginia,
because Virginia was in the first. Maybe that's what it was. Virginia was in the first, because Virginia Tech had never played in it before 2016. Virginia was in the
Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah, the second it was they played West Virginia in the first one, and then the second one they played Pittsburgh, and Matt Schaub was the quarterback.
Yeah,
in that second one.
That'd have been like 2005 or something.
2002 and 2003. Oh, this is great. I'm just gonna keep reading from their Wikipedia. So they're looking for a new sponsor. I guess that's interesting, but not interesting at all to the game or what's happening on the field.
Well, you know what should drum up sponsorship opportunities is talk about Virginia Tech's defensive coordinator job at the press conference.
Well, they're not going to answer questions about that. Like, Justin, who do you think should sponsor this bowl? Don't you think it should be go to their roots and go to a tire company? It's like, I mean, yeah, it's
Is it time for Firestone to step into the breach here?
That's right. But, and it's serious. What looked like it was going to be Mississippi State and was sort of announced, a bunch of reports had come up, and then there was like a last minute haggle within the SEC about who was going to get this game.
Yeah.
And then it was Tennessee for a hot second, and then it kind of switched. So do you think this is more or less interesting than Mississippi State or Tennessee and or Tennessee?
Definitely Tennessee would be more. Tennessee would have a lot more juice.
Why is that?
Well, it's a border state. I mean, I guess Kentucky's a border state too, right? Or is it?
Kentucky's a border state. Okay. I don't think Tennessee's a border state, is it?
Oh, Tennessee is, sure.
Oh man, this is good. I was like, I gotta pull up a USA.
Flip over to Bristol. Bristol straddles the line between Virginia and
so
Tennessee.
It's
west of
this
west
is good
of here.
Radio.
West
this is good.
You remember the Battle of Bristol, right? I mean, you've heard of it. They played the game at Bristol Motor Speedway because it was the sort of a central location between Virginia Tech and Knoxville.
So Kentucky and Tennessee both about the same overlap. So they're both border states, technically.
Yeah, but Tennessee's obviously got more of a history, and I think there's more Tennessee fans in Southwest Virginia than there are Kentucky football fans. There may be some Kentucky basketball fans.
I thought Mississippi State had the best running back in the SEC.
Well, you had the pee thing,
the
pee
thing,
urinating dog storyline. That could have got at least two columns out of that.
Just wrote about that exclusively for 3 weeks. All of them were pretty juiceless because it's lower tier SEC teams, and there was talk of App State. If SEC didn't have enough teams, that they might have been in the picture. And then they're looking for a new coach. I don't know if that would have been a terrible matchup for Virginia Tech, because that's only lose. That's even worse than Kentucky. At least Kentucky's in the SEC. But I thought Mississippi State, and I guess I might be the only one that thought that was the better game
than Tennessee.
Then both of those, because I thought they were the best team of the three.
Yeah, I think you're totally off base on Tennessee. People love that matchup.
I thought that was the best. It would have made for the best football game. That's what I was thinking.
Maybe, yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
Certainly the most urine columns that I could have come up with.
And which is all we really measure.
Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, crank out the coffee before this game.
That's important. That's an important question.
I'm
going
to ask Stoops if anybody's peed on his. Has anybody blown a game in a crazy fashion?
Tomorrow, Charlotte, I have a question from Aaron McFarlane from the Roanoke Times. He's not here today, but he would like to know. Has anybody faked peeing in your school so he can write a column? I don't know how that would go over.
Okay. Well, I guess some would say that we've buried the lead here. We have not talked about Virginia Tech's losing the streak.
That feels like forever ago, because there was a completely different coaching staff.
It was 2 weeks, 2 weeks ago. Virginia, well, actually 8 days ago. Nine days ago? 10 days. It was a Friday. So UVA 39, Virginia Tech 30. Very entertaining game. Could have gone either way for sure. Your thoughts on Virginia finally ending the streak?
I said from the beginning that fans would have been happier with a worse record had they won against Virginia rather than they got those shutouts. And it happened. Fans freaked out about the end of the streak. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's fair. I mean, it's a long time, right? It's a lot of games in a row. Virginia stormed the field, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I think the most important story was that, and nobody wrote about this because I don't cover Virginia, but that a fan jumped off the to get onto the field, jumped down and broke his leg to get on the thing. Yeah, he was out. He was right by the tunnel for Virginia Tech, and so you had to walk past this guy in agony as Broncos trying to find Justin Fuente to shake his hand because they didn't shake the hand on the midfield because of all the fan storming. I guess they're not used to storming the field because obviously some rust there with people not knowing. If you jump 10 feet down on the ground, it's probably going to break your ankle. But as for the game itself, I don't know. Do you think it would have been better if they had gotten blown out and then it was a close game?
The Hokies?
Yeah.
No.
Fans would have been.
I wrote this after the game. I thought if the streak was going to end, this was the best way for it to end. And by that, I mean.
With losing the Coastal.
And I used the metaphor that Lucy didn't get lazy. Charlie Brown had been doing wind sprints. And that's the last time I'm going to use that metaphor in regards to this rivalry. But we've been talking about Lucy pulling the football from.
So what does that mean? So Lucy.
Virginia caught up.
Lucy still had.
Lucy was still. Lucy, if you had reversed the results of the beginning of the season and made them all in the back end of the season, then I would have said this was a disaster for Virginia Tech. But as well as the Hokies have been playing, for Virginia to win it in this fashion on their own field, it re-injects some life into the rivalry. Tech fans, of course, don't want life in the rivalry. They'd like it to be dead forever. They'd like to just, you know, laugh at Virginia all. And I understand that. That's what a rivalry is all about. But in terms of this, me covering it, or somebody who's just looking from, you know, Oklahoma and saying, oh, Virginia Tech and Virginia are playing again, how's that going to go? You know, you don't. The conversations that people have, and I'm not expressing myself well, but I put this in the column too. If you walk to the stadium that Friday, on Black Friday, and you could see all the, you know, tailgates where Virginia Tech fans and Virginia fans are standing side by side. I mean, you can't live your life in this state, even in our part of the state, without interacting daily with people from the other side of the rivalry. Is that correct? You would agree with that.
Sure.
So,
and you're saying that they shouldn't interact?
No, I'm saying they have a lot more in common than they want than you think on social media. Social media is just a place to just throw your barbs and scream and say, oh, you suck.
Right.
In real life, what you do is you have a beer with the guy and you sit there and you talk about the game. Well, next year, the game, the conversation will not be, this will be the year. No, it won't. This will be the year. No, it won't. It'll be actually like, okay, what happens in this game? There's actually some mystery as to what will happen. There you go.
Okay. And Bud Foster did talk a little bit about that. He said you got to have a rivalry. You have to have two teams, two teams compete. But I don't think Virginia Tech fans care that there's another story. They want
the same
story.
No, of course
not. And so, and it's hard. Like I said, I just think that mattered more than anything else. And
of course. No, look, they're going to be upset. They don't want to relinquish the cup. I mean, the cup's been their property forever. And so, how do you expect them to react? Are they finally lose to Virginia? But my point is, if this had happened, let's say, last year or even the year before, let's go the year before because – or let's go the year before that because Virginia Tech was really struggling.
Like, 2017?
let's go a year – one of the years where Tech needed to win.
2015 or 2014.
In order to get to a bowl.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. And so – and Virginia's not very good. Okay, and then they come and beat you.
So you think it's better that Virginia was good, essentially, because that makes some stats. You think it would have been worse for fans dealing with it if they were bad and had upset them, whereas this was an upset, but not really.
Well, they
upset.
Also had a transcendental quarterback. They had a once-in-a-generation quarterback, and if you're a Virginia Tech fan, you can look at that and say, okay, they're not going to have Perkins next year.
So
beat us in Blacksburg without Perkins and see.
So without any justifications, you think Virginia Tech, if they didn't have any justifications for why that they lost, they'd be waking up even have some perspective in the next month or two where they can't, you know, if in a year where they didn't have Perkins, they would be like, what? Why did we lose?
Yeah, how did we lose to this crappy, terrible team that's not even a coastal contender? You know, like not even going to a bowl. How'd they come? How did we lose to them? You know, that would be, I think, the worst way to lose it. Second worst way to lose it is on like a bad call or a missed field goal. You know, it wasn't that. I mean, Virginia came and took it. They made a field goal. Tech didn't miss a field goal. They made a very difficult 48-yard field goal to go ahead, and that put Tech in a bad position. And Tech got, you know, then they brought the house and sacked Hooker and clinched the deal. But I mean, it was a good game. It was a competitive game, and Tech could have won the game, but it wasn't a scenario where I felt like they just coughed it up and choked it away. You know, it was. I thought Virginia took it, and while that's not pleasant for Virginia Tech fans, you can live with it. It's called competition. It's called sports. You know, I mean, that's what sports are.
Well, it's just a tricky spot right now for Fuente because the team has been very up and down the last 2 years. And this is another down note, and you end the season on this. And so it's your last memory, your lingering memory of the team. And you got the bowl game, which, I mean, who remembers that Cincinnati game last year? They don't remember that. And so this year, the Kentucky game, it's not unless they blow out this team and have something impressive, you're going to remember the Virginia game, and the loss, I think, is going to kind of carry this team through the offseason. And so it's just with the streak, I think it just makes for a challenging, because, you know, you had all those good vibes, and now who's going to remember that you shut those teams back to back? I mean, this was a team that if they had won that game, I mean, man, could you have thought of a better, you know, even Foster talked about kissing Cinderella, you know, like getting a chance. And to get stomped by Clemson, what a joy! But it would have still been, you know, this team has had kind of just going to the offseason last couple of years, just lingering sort of doubts about the direction of the program, and where you didn't have that when they won 6 out of 7, I think it's all back for especially the fan base, where they're just looking at this team as like, what do we have?
I'm going to disagree with you slightly. I definitely agree that people are going to remember this Virginia loss, of course, but I do remember Virginia last year losing in a very devastating fashion in Blacksburg. And you said, well, it doesn't matter what happens down in the Belk Bowl. You know, who gives a crap what happened? They put all their eggs in the Virginia Tech basket, and they lost. And they lost in a terrible way. And, then Perkins went out and had the game of his life, and they stomped South Carolina 28-0. And all of a sudden – You said, well, this is a resilient team. You know, this isn't a team that's going to dwell on that Virginia Tech loss. I think Virginia Tech, while maybe not something to that extreme, because it was sort of a incremental growth that was going on in Charlottesville as opposed to the up and down that you talked about in Blacksburg. I think you can erase some of the ill feelings if you put in a really good performance here. I'm saying, you know, you probably need to win by 2 touchdowns or something like that to feel like, okay, I can remember now the momentum they had built before.
You can detach yourself, but they lose. That's only going to increase kind of the concern.
Yeah, they can't lose.
No.
That's not good.
Well, you went to the championship game. And I did think it would have been an interest. I think that they ranked – so the College Football Playoff Committee ranked UVA 24, so there wasn't a discussion about the Orange Bowl,
right?
The automatic rankings. But if they had not been ranked, I do think the Orange Bowl would have had a discussion.
I think they would have taken Virginia Tech.
You think so? But I think it would have at least been – I don't know what they would have done. You know, you can't – who knows? But I think they would have had to have a discussion, right?
Did you see the quote from the Orange Bowl
they would have considered
commissioner
both
or whatever
of the guys?
His name is? No, he was like, well – once they had put him in the rankings, we had to take him, you know. And he was,
but no, it was.
I'm
it
paraphrasing,
was like,
but,
yeah,
he, was
but
like,
no, you did.
He was like, the others we right. would have looked at would have been Virginia Tech and Wake Forest.
Yeah, because they were 24, so they had to go. But I think it would have been a discussion because you were at that Clemson game, UVA game.
And I was.
How uneven, how unmatched was that game?
It was one of the worst games I've ever seen. In terms of just being entertained. You know, I know Hokie fans probably were at home enjoying the heck out of it. But, you know, as somebody who was there just hoping to see some competitiveness, and you saw a little bit early, I guess, you know, Perkins making some plays early on. And
it didn't matter how many long completions or Clemson could have scored every time.
That was what was striking. It was just that Virginia's defense had no answer for the offense, and the backup quarterback played the entire fourth quarter, and they still won 62-17. I mean, this is you know, it was. I wrote about the fact that I think it's a problem for the ACC. I mean, I think it's a problem for the ACC that one, Clemson didn't face a ranked opponent all year until they played Virginia, which is now not in the AP rankings after that loss. And two, that the title game is a foregone conclusion.
It's a joke. Yeah.
It was 90% this is my estimation, 90% Clemson fans there. And if you're a Virginia fan, why would you go? Like, why would you go watch a bloodletting other than to just say you were there for a title game? You know, you knew the way it was going to go. And that's not Clemson's fault. And I think even you're seeing even Bronco is – or not Bronco, Dabo. There's a lot of O names in the coaching positions. But Dino, you got Dino at Syracuse. Jimbo, you used to have. There's a lot of O's. It's hard to keep them all track.
All analysis you can only get from the Lunchbox
Dabo. You could tell in his comments leading up to the game, you know, he's sort of frustrated with it too. He didn't come out and say this league sucks.
Well, he thought
like,
that people were discounting them, but as they
because
should.
Because the league sucks.
But as they should. I mean, they after the first couple weeks, they beat everybody by more than 40, I think it was, or whatever
yeah.
it was. And Wofford, I think, had the most points against them in that stretch, probably because they had the backups in for
probably
three quarters. What do you think Tech would have done? Would it have been the same?
I think it would have been – Yeah, probably 25-point loss instead of, what, 30?
I think 45? I think Tech's defense, even though the defense gave up tons of points, they probably would have slowed him down for a little bit because they do weird things. And it seems like when Bud Foster schemes for a guy, especially Trevor Lawrence that hasn't seen him before, mm-hmm. they can trip him up for, like, a quarter or two. Offensively, I think Tech would have been just decimated. Like, yeah. I don't think they would have.
I mean, you have an appreciation watching Clemson on TV and watching and seeing the scores come up on the bottom line and just seeing how dominant they are. But then when you go and watch them play and you see Lawrence and the way he throws, I mean, he stands so tall in the pocket. You know, he's such a big guy. And then he just, man, it's so much mustard on those throws. It's really impressive to watch. He can just really get it down the field in a hurry. And I think that would have been all kinds of problem for Virginia Tech, just as it was for Virginia. I mean, yeah. I don't think Virginia Tech is kicking itself saying, wow, if we'd have been there, we could have won.
No, I don't. Yeah. And you didn't see that. No Virginia Tech fan was like, oh, man, I wish we were there. We would have given them a real fight.
Yeah.
Or, like, it would have been much different. I mean, they had some glee in the fact that Virginia literally could not stop
a
single player
strong,
on the offense, or it was bad. But, yeah, I mean, what a prize, right? That you beat your rival and that streak for 15 years and you just get embarrassed in primetime on national TV.
Yeah. Well, I think I predicted 45-20, so that would have been a slight covering of the spread.
That was very generous.
Well, yeah, it was generous. And part of it was the whole nothing to lose mentality and the fact that I have a lot of appreciation for Perkins. And, you know,
they didn't play with nothing to lose. That Bronco made some conservative decisions. He had the ball.
Yeah,
there.
He punted one early when their offense was playing really well and their defense was, of course, not all game. He punted in plus territory that made no sense on like a third or fourth and four. Or
and when you're in that situation, I think you have to sort of. I'm not sure why teams don't be like, look, this is a four down game. We're going to go for it every time. We're going to almost like a game plan that Fuente had against Wake Forest, where it's like, if we don't have the ball 75% of the time, we're not even going to come close.
Right.
Like, why not? I mean, what's the difference if you don't make those fourth downs? You give up. I mean, they're going to run out of time eventually, right?
Well, as I tweeted, why not? Well, you just want to give a 54-yard you want to give up an 84-yard
right,
touchdown.
Right, what's the difference?
At
the end of the game, the score might be worse. Like, if you miss all those fourth down opportunities, you might lose by 14 more. But at what point is the difference? Maybe you don't. Maybe you can cover. Maybe you can actually keep it competitive because otherwise you have no chance. And coaches don't do that. Now, it's very rare that coaches do that, but I think as analytics and things get embraced, somebody's going to come up with these numbers and say, like, look, you have a 0% chance of beating Clemson. If you go for it, maybe you have a 2% chance,
and
right?
That was disappointing to me because Bronco's an analytics guy.
Yeah,
he studies that kind of stuff, and he should know better. And you know, and he's also a very blunt guy. He knows what they're up against. He doesn't sugarcoat that kind of stuff to those guys. You know, he's the one who said we only have this many ACC caliber players on our team. You know, which is a very insulting thing.
But I'm not sure. I am surprised that they didn't sort of take that approach where it's like we got nothing. We just ended this terrible streak. We're riding high. Let's do something crazy, right? Let's go nuts and try something. They lost by more than 40, right?
62-17.
Yeah.
Or 63.
Yeah,
I think it was 62.
I mean, they just got crushed. So what is the difference?
Yeah. No, you're right. I'm in total agreement with you. All right. You want to get to our pick three?
Sure.
Okay.
You want me to go first?
Sure.
Ghostbusters Afterlife. Did you see the trailer, the new Ghostbusters movie?
I saw it pop up on my Twitter.
That was
thing
good.
And I didn't.
I'm looking forward to it. It's a continuation of the originals. They did that one that was sort of separate, kind of a reboot. This one looks like the little girl or the family that is going to be connected to Harold Ramis's character Egon. That'll be his grandchildren. He has passed away. So, but evoked sort of the tone of the original. I showed my kids who have just seen the first one, not the second one, and they loved everything. They were really once they showed the Ecto-1, the car. My kids went crazy. They were really excited. They're in. So I'm excited for that. This summer comes out. I thought the trailer was fun.
Okay. Yeah, I like the original.
Yeah, the original.
I haven't seen any of the. I guess I did see Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, that's a little darker, so we haven't shown the kids that. The Viggo, Carpathian, the painting.
Yeah.
But yeah, the kids are like, is this another one? I'm like, yeah, it's super exciting.
Well, speaking of movies, my first one will be Hallmark movies. You ever watch any of them?
I do not.
Okay. The Christmas movies.
I've 47 of them.
I've gotten into these with my daughter and my wife watches them with us. And my son does not. He's 14 and he goes up to his room.
Do you play a drinking game when you do it?
No.
Because there's got to be like a drinking game. There's got to be like a drinking game.
My daughter jokes that it's always a small town. You know, she always falls for a small town baker, you know, who just happens to know how to make the best Christmas cookies in the world. We watched one last night. It was called A Christmas Bride. It was fantastic.
There is a there's very, very many links for Hallmark Christmas movie drinking games.
There you go.
Take a drink when a character's name is related to Christmas. Holly, Nick, Chris. Someone disses fake Christmas trees. There's a mistletoe. A newcomer partakes in an old family town tradition.
Uh-huh.
There's an ugly sweater. Someone gets snowed on.
Uh-huh.
Someone drinks hot chocolate cider.
I've been wasted last night. Wasted.
A big city person is transplanted to a small town.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
A magical deal is made with Santa or an angel.
That didn't happen.
There's a reference to a dead relative.
Yes. Dad.
Jingle Bells is played.
Sure it was, yeah.
Yeah. So.
Okay. So yeah, totally wasted. Yeah. But I enjoy them for the fact that my daughter's very sarcastic, just like her dad.
Her commentary.
And we make a lot of commentaries.
So you don't watch them like literally like for the enjoyment of seeing love stories.
No, I mean, you get into the plot a little bit if it's well done, but most of them are.
Are any of them well done?
Last night's was okay. I recognized the gal from this movie from, she was in one of the original Masters of Horror show. Have you ever heard of Masters of Horror?
I vaguely remember the title, but
It was great. Yeah. I think it was on Showtime, but they took like the best directors of horror movies and they said make a 60-minute film, and they had a really high batting average in success there. Go ahead, you go.
So
number two.
I read a book after the Virginia game that weekend, The Substitution Order by Martin Clark. I guess he's a Virginia-based author. It's like a legal, sort of legal thriller. Different, a little bit different than my normal stuff that I read. It was very, very good. It's got a kind of an interesting cover. It's like a building hanging on a cliff. And it's about this attorney that has been disbarred, and he's working at a sub shop. And his life gets entangled in all sorts of problems. But it's very good. I'm going to try to check out something else he's written, and I thought it was fun that the main character had worked in Roanoke for most of his life. And so
cool.
A lot of towns that mentioned around here. So Virginia-based writer, so always support local authors, right? That's got to, right? So, so I read that, and that was very good. I'd recommend that if you're looking for a book to purchase for someone for the holidays.
All right. I got the best stick-to-sports complaint I've ever gotten, I think. When I wrote about the Commonwealth Cup streak ending, I used a metaphor. I said something along the lines of, I said, let's face it, the movie Groundhog Day was only popular because Bill Murray was in it. I said the plot itself was tedious. And some guy replied at the bottom of the story, he says, I'm paraphrasing, but he was like, Groundhog Day is not just a Bill Murray vehicle. Maybe you should just stick with writing about sports. So he's very protective of that movie. And I'm coming to find out that a lot of people agree with this man.
Groundhog Day is like that's a.
I found it tedious.
Oh, my God.
Every day the same thing. And it's like, okay, I understand. I get it. But like.
You've got some unpopular movie opinions.
I do. But you know what's popular in the world today? Is like The Rock and pro wrestling, and I don't want to be popular. I don't care. Like, I don't want to be a Rock fan. I don't want to watch.
Ironically, the next one on my list is the second Jumanji movie with The Rock, because we're going to be taking the kids to see it because they really like the first one. And you know, me and my wife really like the original.
Stick to sports.
We like the original, and the second one, or I mean the remake. We were kind of leery of it, but it was kind of fun and light, and the kids really liked it. And the kids don't rarely watch, you know, Ghostbusters. The live action movies are still sort of boring to them. They prefer Pixar and cartoons and things. But the Jumanji, and I think that's part of the appeal is The Rock, that he's sort of this cartoon character in real life. He's not like a real person, because you know, how could you be real, and like he's insane. Mm-hmm. It's just his aura and his personality. But so the kids really like it, and they like kind of the goofy, you know, aspect of these characters playing kids, you know. So we'll be seeing that, and so I guess we're anti Aaron McFarlane.
No, you're just you.
I like pop culture.
I am
one of the masses.
And I'm also saying people that like pro wrestling. I'm not bashing you.
Sound like you're bashing.
No. I mean, I like NASCAR. A lot of people don't like NASCAR.
What is the difference between pro wrestling and NASCAR?
It's very. There's a lot of similarities. Yeah, you're right. All right, my third one. I'm embarrassed to admit. I have never read Ball 4 by Jim Bowden. Have you read Ball 4?
No.
Okay. I always just assumed, you know, because it was written, I think, in the 70s, early 70s. You know, most people know of the book. If they haven't read it, it's you know, by a pitcher who pitched for the Yankees and the Seattle Pilots, and he told all, you know, and that was like the first real sports book that wasn't just, oh, Johnny's working hard in the off season, looking forward to a big year with the Yankees. You know, like this
your
was
voice of the.
Yeah.
That so, sounds like it was before the 60s that they were doing that.
Well, I always just assumed that this book, you know, because it's always referred to as that first tell-all sports book, was just going to be, you know, oh, travails on the
right.
on the, you know, at the hotel and things like that. And I was like, I don't really, you know, whatever. The book is hilarious. Like, Bowden is really funny. The guy who edited it did a fantastic job. Apparently, what Bowden did was just talking to a recorder. It was like a diary
right.
format.
Transcribe it, yeah.
And then transcribed it, and then it was edited by somebody. And it's fantastic. The guy, Bowden reminds me, my college coach at Maryland was Tom Bradley. He pitched in the big leagues with the White Sox. He's probably a big fan of his, being a White Sox guy. But, and so he had all sorts of, you know, big league stories, but he was also just, you know, smart ass and funny. And this guy is very similar to that. And it reminds me a lot of, probably anybody who's a sports fan or a big baseball fan probably has at least heard of it. Most people probably read it. I would recommend if you haven't, go do it because it's much better than I anticipated it being.
We'll talk about how you having the pulse of pop culture. You're recommending a book from the 60s about a baseball player. That's like, you know, I mean, you're not going to get, I mean, that's, yeah.
And when you're done, grab a cup of hot cocoa and watch yourself.
That's actually more pop culture. I mean, that's like the dichotomy of hiring Charlie Wiles and hiring Justin Hamilton. Watching Hallmark movies and recommending a baseball book that was published in the 60s or 70s. So that's very... those things don't go together. One of those things is very. Both of them are very strange. But you should do. You should do for the podcast to test. Uh-huh. You should get one of those drinking game sheets. And the next time you watch a Hallmark movie, do it. Legitimately do it.
And then take a breathalyzer.
or like measure how many beers you've had or how drunk you are. Or do that for like an entire week and then write a column. And then you could expense all the alcohol.
That's right.
Six, like how drunk?
Six cases of
then,
Sam Adams Winter
and
Brew.
And your obituary could be the next day where it's like he did not make it. He died of alcohol poisoning.
Yeah, I guess that would be a good way to go.
So there's that. So next week we'll come back and you could tell us how many, you know, what's the average? You know, like if you did 5 days of the movies, what's your average beer intake on that?
I like that idea. I don't know that the wife would appreciate it as much as
you
got to
say. Look, it's for work, honey. It's what it is. What it is.
Do you want me to get fired or what?
Exactly.
All right. Well, that's just about do it for this episode. We will try to get it together again in between now and the bowl and talk about the actual bowl matchup a lot more in depth, and also maybe hit on a few other bowls out there involving ACC.
Are you doing your list this year?
I'll do my bowl guide. Apparently, that's running on the 21st, which I think is the first day of bowls. That's at Saturday.
So you think maybe you pick three. We could do like your best three bets for the fans.
Yeah. I can give you my lock of the bowl season. We had a good year last year against the spread. We had, I think, a run of 2 years in a row that was bad. But before that, I think I went on like a 10-year run where every year I was hitting, 60% or so like that. I mean, it was pretty good. So it's usually pretty good. So hopefully I'll have that done by the time we get back together and we can go over all that. Anything else you want to add, Mike?
No. I'm
okay. All right. Well, we thank you for joining us. Have a happy holiday. If we don't talk to you before then, if we do, we'll see you then for Mike Nizelik. See, I got it right. Mike Nizelik. This is Aaron McFarling. We'll catch you next time.